The Columbia Workshop presents two sessions from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. Mr. John Hall Wheelock, American poet and editor, will read Burnt Norton, and Mr. James Johnson Sweeney, director of the Department of Painting and Sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, will read Little Gidding. The Columbia Workshop has asked Mr. Sweeney, who is now completing a new study of T.S. Eliot, to tell us something about the man and his work before we actually present the poems. Mr. Sweeney.
Ironically enough, an American-born writer, Thomas Stearns Eliot, is today commonly acknowledged England's leading contemporary poet. And with further irony, Eliot, for years regarded as a poet of disillusionment, the author of The Waste Land, during the last 10 years has produced perhaps the greatest English religious poem of the 20th century, Four Quartets, from which work we are today offering the first and final sections. Eliot was born in St. Louis in 1888. After graduating from Harvard University, he studied philosophy at the Sorbonne in Paris, at Oxford in England. In 1915, he married in England and settled there, later becoming a British subject. In 1922, his long poem, The Wasteland, was awarded the Dial Prize in New York. The same year, he founded the Criterion in London, which was to become the leading literary magazine of the next decade and a half. During this period, his reputation as a literary critic and poet steadily grew. Eliot, as a poet, is notable for his interest in everyday conversational rhythms and homely imagery, for an understatement that is frequently unappreciated in quarters where rhetoric is demanded of poetry. But if his expression, he is essentially a man of his own period, he recognizes the timelessness of art. And in the two sections of the Four Quartets, which you are going to hear this afternoon, Burnt Norton and Little Gidding, Eliot builds up word pictures and word rhythms around the theme of eternity. From the title, Four Quartets, it is evident the author wishes us to see in each of these sections a pattern of ideas and relationships such as we are accustomed to find in musical compositions. In Burnt Norton, he symbolizes the timelessness of reality by the constant return of childhood memories, in Little Gidding by the deathlessness of love. But in poetry as rich as Eliot's, as in all true art, sensuous appreciation should come first and intellectual consideration later. For this brief reading, therefore, let us suggest a concentration on the word pictures and word musics, the music of the poem, as we might approach two quartets of Beethoven. Mr. John Hall Wheelock, himself well known to you as a poet, will open the reading of Eliot's Four Quartets with the first section, Burnt Norton.
Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility only in a world of speculation. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory down the passage which we did not take towards the door we never opened into the rose garden. My words echo thus in your mind. But to what purpose disturbing the dust on a bowl of rose leaves, I do not know. Other echoes inhabit the garden. Shall we follow? Quick, said the bird, find them, round the corner. Through the first gate, into our first world, shall we follow the deception of the thrush? Into our first world. There they were, dignified, invisible, moving without pressure over the dead leaves, in the autumn heat, through the vibrant air. And the bird called in response to the unheard music hidden in the shrubbery, and the unseen eye-beam crossed, for the roses had the look of flowers that are looked at. There they were as our guests, accepted and accepting. So we moved, and they, in a formal pattern, along the empty alley into the box circle, to look down into the drained pool. dry, the pool, dry concrete, brown-edged, and the pool was filled with water out of sunlight, and the lotus rose quietly, quietly. The surface glittered out of heart of light, and they were behind us, reflected in the pool. Then a cloud passed, and the pool was empty. "Go," said the bird, for the leaves were full of children, hidden excitedly, containing laughter. "Go, go, go," said the bird. "Humankind cannot bear very much reality." Time past, and time future, what might have been and what has been, point to one end, which is always present. Garlic and sapphires in the mud clot the bedded axle tree. The trilling wire in the blood sings below inveterate scars and reconciles forgotten wars. The dance along the artery, the circulation of the lymph are figured in the drift of stars. Ascend to summer in the tree. We move above the moving tree in light upon the figured leaf, and here upon the sodden floor below the boarhound and the boar pursue their pattern as before, but reconciled among the stars. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point there the dance is, but neither arrest nor movement. And do not call it fixity, where past and future are gathered. Neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline. Except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance. I can only say, there we have been. But I cannot say where, and I cannot say how long, for that is to place it in time. The inner freedom from the practical desire, the release from action and suffering, release from the inner and the outer compulsion, yet surrounded by a grace of sense, a white light still and moving, erhebung without motion, concentration without elimination, both a new world and the old made explicit, understood in the completion of its partial ecstasy, the resolution of its partial horror. Yet the enchainment of past and future, woven in the weakness of the changing body, protects mankind from heaven and damnation, which flesh cannot endure. Time past and time future allow but a little consciousness. To be conscious is not to be in time. But only in time can the moment in the rose garden, the moment in the arbor where the rain beat, the moment in the drafty church at Smokefall be remembered, involved with past and future. Only through time, time is conquered. Here is a place of disaffection, time before and time after in a dim light, neither daylight, investing form with lucid stillness, turning shadow into transient beauty, with slow rotation suggesting permanence, nor darkness to purify the soul, emptying the sensual with deprivation, cleansing affection from the temporal. Neither plenitude nor vacancy, only a flicker over the strained, time-ridden faces, distracted from distraction by distraction, filled with fancies and empty of meaning, tumid apathy, with no concentration, men and bits of paper whirled by the cold wind that blows before and after time, wind in and out of unwholesome lungs, time before and time after. Eructation of unhealthy souls into the faded air, the torpid driven on the wind that sweeps the gloomy hills of London, Hampstead and Clerkenwell, Camden and Putney, Highgate, Primrose and Ludgate. Not here, not here the darkness in this twittering world. Descend lower, descend only into the world of perpetual solitude, world not world, but that which is not world. Internal darkness, deprivation and destitution of all property, desiccation of the world of sense, evacuation of the world of fancy, inoperancy of the world of spirit. This is the one way, and the other is the same, not in movement, but abstention from movement, while the world moves in appetency on its mettled ways of time past and time future. Time and the bell have buried the day. The black cloud carries the sun away. Will the sunflower turn to us? Will the clematis stray down, bend to us? Tendril and spray, clutch and cling? Chill, fingers of you be curled down on us? After the kingfisher's wing has answered light to light and is silent, the light is still at the still point of the turning world. Words move, music moves, only in time. But that which is only living can only die. Words, after speech, reach into the silence. Only by the form, the pattern, can words or music reach the stillness, as a Chinese jar still moves perpetually in its stillness. Not the stillness of the violin while the note lasts, not that only, but the coexistence. Or say that the end precedes the beginning, and the end and the beginning were always there, before the beginning and after the end. And all is always now. Words strain, crack, and sometimes break under the burden, under the tension, slip, slide, perish, decay with imprecision, will not stay in place, will not stay still. Shrieking voices, scolding, mocking, or merely chattering, always assail them. The word in the desert is most attacked by voices of temptation. The crying shadow in the funeral dance, the loud lament of the disconsolate chimera. The detail of the pattern is movement, as in the figure of the 10 stairs. Desire itself is movement, not in itself desirable. Love is itself unmoving, only the cause and end of movement, timeless and undesiring, except in the aspect of time, caught in the form of limitation between unbeing and being. Sudden, in a shaft of sunlight, even while the dust moves, there rises the hidden laughter of children in the foliage. Quick now, here, now, always. Ridiculous, the waste, sad time, stretching before and after.
James Johnson Sweeney continues the Columbia Workshop's presentation of T.S. Eliot's 4 quartets by reading the final movement entitled Little Gidding.
Midwinter's spring is its own season, sempiternal though sodden towards sundown, suspended in time between pole and tropic. When the short day is brightest with frost and fire, the brief sun flames the ice on pond and ditches in windless cold that is the heart's heat, reflecting in a watery mirror, a glare that is blindness in the early afternoon, and a glow more intense than blaze, branch, or brazier stirs the dumb spirit, no wind but Pentecostal fire in the dark time of the year. Between melting and freezing, the soul's sap quivers. There is no earth smell or smell of living thing. This is the springtime, but not in time's covenant. Now the hedgerow is blanched for an hour with transitory blossom of snow, a bloom more sudden than that of summer, neither budding nor fading, nor in the scheme of generation. Where is the summer? The unimaginable zero summer. If you came this way, taking the route you would be likely to take, from the place you would be likely to come from, if you came this way in Maytime, you would find the hedges white again in May, with voluptuary whiteness. It would be the same at the end of the journey. If you came at night like a broken king, if you came at day, not knowing what you came for, it would be the same. When you leave the rough road and turn behind the pigsty to the dull facade and the tombstone, and what you thought you came for is only a shell, a husk of meaning from which the purpose breaks only when it is fulfilled, if at all. Either you had no purpose, or the purpose is beyond the end you figured and is altered in fulfillment. There are other places which also are the world's end, some at the seashores, or over a dark lake, or in a desert, or a city, but this is the nearest in place and time, now and in England. If you came this way, taking any route, starting from anywhere, at any time or at any season, it would always be the same. You would have to put off sense and notion. You are not here to verify, instruct yourself, or inform curiosity, or carry report. You are here to kneel where prayer has been valid. And prayer is more than an order of words, the conscious occupation of the praying mind, or the sound of the voice praying. And what the dead had no speech for when living, they can tell you being dead. The communication of the dead is tongued with fire beyond the language of the living. Here, the intersection of the timeless moment is England and nowhere. Never and always. Ash on an old man's sleeve is all the ash-burnt roses leave. Dust in the air suspended marks the place where a story ended. Dust in breathed was a house, the wall, the wainscot, and the mouse. The death of hope and despair, this is the death of air. There are flood and drought over the eyes and in the mouth. Dead water and dead sand contending for the upper hand. The parched, eviscerate soil gapes at the vanity of toil, laughs without mirth. This is the death of earth. Water and fire succeed, the town, the pasture, and the weed. Water and fire deride the sacrifice that we denied. Water and fire shall rot the marred foundations we forgot of sanctuary and choir. This is the death of water and fire. In the uncertain hour before the morning, near the ending of interminable night, at the recurrent end of the unending, after the dark dove with the flickering tongue had passed below the horizon of his homing, while the dead leaves still rattled on like tin over the asphalt, where no other sound was between three districts whence the smoke arose, I met one walking, loitering, and hurried as if blown toward me like the metal leaves before the urban dawn wind, unresisting. And as I fixed upon the downturned face that pointed scrutiny which we challenged the first met stranger in the waning dusk, I caught the sudden look of some dead master whom I had known, forgotten, half-recalled, both one and many, in the brown-baked features, the eyes of a familiar compound ghost, both intimate and unidentifiable. So I assumed a double part, and cried and heard another's voice cry, "What, are you here?" Although we were not, I was still the same, knowing myself, yet being someone other, and he a face still forming. Yet the words sufficed to compel the recognition they preceded, and so, compliant to the common wind, too strange to each other for misunderstanding, and conquered at this intersection time of meeting nowhere, no before and after, we trod the pavement in a dead patrol. I said, "The wonder that I feel is easy, yet ease is cause of wonder. Therefore speak. I may not comprehend, may not remember." And he, "I am not eager to rehearse my thought and theory, which you may have forgotten. These things have served their purpose. Let them be. So with your own, and let pray they be forgiven by others, as I pray you to forgive, both bad and good. Last season's fruit is eaten, and the full-fed beast shall kick the empty pail. For last year's words belong to last year's language, and next year's words await another voice. But as the passage now presents no hindrance, after the spirit unappeased in Peregrine between two worlds become much like each other, so I find words I never thought to speak, in streets I never thought I should revisit when I left my body on a distant shore. Since our concern was speech, and speech impelled us to purify the dialect of the tribe and urge the mind to aftersight and foresight, let me disclose the gifts reserved for age to set a crown upon your lifetime's effort. First, the cold friction of expiring sense without enchantment, offering no promise but bitter tastelessness of shadow fruit, as body and soul begin to fall asunder. Second, the conscious impotence of rage at human folly, and the laceration of laughter at what ceases to amuse. And last, the rending pain of reenactment of all that you have done and been, the shame of motives late revealed, and the awareness of things ill done, done to others' harm, which once you took for exercise of virtue. Then fool's approval stings, and honor stains. From wrong to wrong the exasperated spirit proceeds, unless restored by that refining fire where you must move in measure like a dancer. The day was breaking. In the disfigured street he left me with a kind of valediction and faded on the blowing of the horn. There are three conditions which often look alike, yet differ completely. Flourish in the same hedge grow, attachment to self and to things and to persons, detachment from self and from things and from persons, and growing between them indifference, which resembles the other as death resembles life, being between two lives, unflowering between the live and the dead nettle. This is the use of memory for liberation, not less of love, but expanding of love beyond desire, and so liberation from the future as well as from the past. Thus, love of a country begins as attachment to our own field of action and comes to find that action of little importance, though never indifferent. History may be servitude. History may be freedom. See now they vanish, the faces and places, the self which, as it could, loved them, to become renewed, transfigured in another pattern. Sin is behovely, but all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. If I think again of this place and of people, not wholly commendable, of no immediate kin or kindness, but some of peculiar genius, all touched by a common genius, united in the strife which divided them, if I think of a king at nightfall, of three men and more on the scaffold, and a few who died forgotten in other places here and abroad, and of one who died blind and quiet, why should we celebrate these dead men more than the dying? It is not to ring the bell backward, nor is it an incantation to summon the specter of a rose. We cannot revive old factions. We cannot restore old policies or follow an antique drum. These men and those who opposed them and those whom they opposed accept the constitution of silence and are folded in a single party. Whatever we inherit from the fortunate, we have taken from the defeated what they had to leave us, a symbol perfected in death. And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well by the purification of the motive in the ground of our beseeching. The dove descending breaks the air with flame of incandescent terror, of which the tongues declare the one discharge from sin and error, the only hope or else despair, lies in the choice of pyre or pyre, to be redeemed from fire, by fire. Who then devised the torment? Love. Love is the unfamiliar name behind the hands that wove the intolerable shirt of flame which human power cannot remove. We only live, only suspire, consumed by either fire or fire. What we call the beginning is often the end, and to make an end is to make a beginning. The end is where we start from. And every phrase and every sentence that is right, where every word is at home, taking its place to support the others, the word neither diffident nor ostentatious, an easy commerce of the old and the new, the common word exact without vulgarity, the formal word precise but not pedantic, the complete concert dancing together, every phrase and every sentence is an end and a beginning, every poem an epitaph. And any action is a step to the block, to the fire, down the sea's throat, or to an illegible stone. And that is where we start. We die with the dying, see they depart, we go with them. We are born with the dead, see they return and bring us with them. The moment of the rose and the moment of the yew tree are of equal duration. A people without history is not redeemed from time, for history is a pattern of timeless moments. So when the light fails on a winter's afternoon in a secluded chapel, history is now and England. With the drawing of this love and the voice of this calling, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and to know the place for the first time. Through the unknown, remembered gate, when the last of earth left to discover is that which was the beginning. At the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick now, here now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything, and all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, when the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire, and the fire and the rose are one.
The Columbia Workshop has presented two of the four parts of T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. The program was produced by Robert Louis Cheyon and presented by John Hall Wheelock, American poet and editor, and James Johnson Sweeney, director of the Department of Painting and Sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. As Mr. Sweeney has pointed out, ironically enough, an American-born writer, Thomas Stearns Eliot, is today commonly acknowledged England's leading contemporary poet. And with further irony, Eliot, for years regarded as a poet of disillusionment, the author of Wasteland, during the last 10 years has produced perhaps the greatest English religious poem of the 20th century, Four Quartets, from which work we have today offered the first and final movements. Next week, the Columbia Workshop will present Irvin Shaw's New Yorker magazine story, Act of Faith, as adapted for radio by Charles S. Monroe of the CBS Program Writing Division. John Dietz will direct for the workshop. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.